We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
John Tetta! What a screamer! What a screamer!
Arsenal Online community still undefeated, but this time for a good cause. This is the Arsenal Vision post-match podcast. My name's Alex Smith. You can block me on Twitter, Yankee Gunner. We're going to do a podcast, and we're going to come up with stuff to talk about. Ligue 1, Ligue 2, they're not doing football anymore. The Dutch League, they're not doing football anymore. UEFA wants people to do football so that UEFA can have its future earnings revenue understood. Players want contracts. There's all kinds of things to discuss, and here to discuss it with me is Tim. You can find him on Twitter. Roberto, hello, Tim.
Hello there.
And Clive, you can find him on Twitter, ClivePAFC. Hello, Clive.
Hello, hello.
Hello, indeed. Paul will be back in the future. Scott will be back in the future. These are hectic and challenging times. I hope you're doing well. And I just want to let everybody know, we had the debate. We talked about the players giving back part of their salary. And me, I will call myself out. I was like, they shouldn't do it. Not because I hate the club and helping people, but because I had reasons. We won't relitigate the reasons, but what we did agree on that podcast is helping out is important. It sure is, and so we are. We are matching every pound you give to the Arsenal Foundation, up to £5,000. We want to blow past £10,000. We launched this yesterday, and we're already well on our way there and beyond. The Arsenal Foundation has been wonderful in helping us set this up. They do great work in the community. This is a community that is connected to the club, and that is the reason we are all here together. I think as much as we agree on football and disagree on football and argue and, you know, laugh and joke and meme and all the things we do, the club brings us together. It's why I am recording with these two fine gentlemen today. It is why you are listening to us, which we love you for and appreciate, and all the things we always talk about. But yeah, it is really special to remind ourselves sometimes just how much we do care about this club and this community and our willingness to support it. So if you'd like to help support the community in COVID-19 response, we are doing a fundraiser. You can go to our Just Giving page, /fundraising/ Arsenal Vision Podcast. But an easier URL might just be thearsenalvisionpodcast.com /donate. And that will then let you go right to the Just Giving page. All the money goes to the Arsenal Foundation. We are matching. So you give, we give. We're going to give anyway. But you give more, we give more. And we want to really blow away the goal and give money to a good cause and show Arsenal that we are willing to give back a little bit. Now, look, obviously, if you can't, if times are tough for you, as they have been for some of us on the pod, then totally understood. Give to your means, and if your means are nothing right now, then, you know, just maybe sharing the tweet or the Facebook post or something like that would be helpful. But, you know, we are all in it together, and we certainly want to do our part. So, Tim, Clive, I know you guys are proud and excited of this. Before we move on from it, just real quick, because we are going to talk football. Tim, you know, the guys at the Arsenal Foundation and gals have been really supportive of this. It's a great cause, and it's one that's connected to the club. So not much more needs to be said, but great to give back, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know a couple of guys who work for and with the foundation very closely from Arsenal. And, you know, I've done like articles with them in the past and events and things like that. And I can tell you that all of this is going to really, really worthwhile places, to people who really, really need it. And a good friend of mine, Luke, who works for, he's a disability officer at Arsenal, but obviously does lots of work with the foundation, lots of outreach work. And he's been out delivering food parcels every day, particularly to kind of children who are vulnerable, or, you know, in bad economic states, whose parents are in bad economic states because of what's happened and lack of accessibility to food banks and things like that. And they've been really, really active. And a lot of guys who usually, you know, just work at Arsenal, and particularly in the hub, which people who've been to the stadium will know sits like right next to the stadium, and it's a little community space with a couple of five-a-side pitches and everything. And a lot of the guys that usually work there obviously aren't working there at the moment, so they're out in the community and they're delivering food and amenities and things like that, and you know, just trying to help people in Islington's lives feel a little bit more normal at the moment. So yeah, absolutely, really, really, really proud to be able to kind of help do a little bit for the foundation. And obviously it has an Arsenal link, a very, very strong Arsenal link, and that's entirely appropriate given this podcast and given the fact that we get money for doing this podcast. So I think it's entirely appropriate that we give some of that back to the very kind of thing and the community that binds us all together and means that we can have great fun doing this podcast.
Yeah, well said. And I mean, look, there are lots of worthwhile charities, and you know, you certainly don't need to play the game of which charity is most worthwhile. The point is to do something, and this one made a lot of sense because it is part of the organization that connects us all. And Clive, I mean, you know, it is hard for me to connect with the community as a local community. I connect with it as a global community, but the local community really comes to represent the global community. When Arsenal won the first of the trio of FA Cups to break the trophy drought, and you know, there's the parade through the streets and there's so many people there, you know, even though I couldn't be there, you feel like you're a part of that community, like you're a screaming voice in the crowd as Jack Wilshere is saying, what do we think of Tottenham, and Wojciech Szczesny is getting drunk as can be. I mean, it is at the end of the day a community organization that we support, and this helps the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people, especially local fans, obviously, who, not everyone lives around the ground, or everyone, you know, trains in, but that whole area around the ground is just full of life memories for many people, you know, whether they be pre-game, post-game. And yeah, it's a part of London that holds a special place for me from most of my adult life, basically. I've lost many a memory on those streets. And I think when you first came up with the idea, Elliot, and we all spoke about it offline, I thought it was a really appropriate thing to do. It just felt like the right thing to do. And it befits what we try to do on the podcast, try to act with a bit of integrity. And this whole COVID experience is something that will one day, hopefully, we'll all look back on. And I said earlier online, I said, basically, when we look back, I want to say to myself, how did we act? How did I act? Did I act in the right way? Did I behave appropriately to allow things to recover? Did I give something back? Because at present, you know, I'm in a fortunate position, and I'm still working and still doing okay. So have I done my thing? And I think this is a great vehicle and something that fits my life and many people's life listening. This is the vehicle I thought we'd try to do our thing with. And I think it's a great idea. And thanks to everybody that supported us so far. And I hope people recognize why we're doing this and continue to support us going forward.
Yeah. Well said. We won't do any more on this. We'll get on to the football chat. But, you know, it is interesting sometimes when you realize, you know, you're going through a personal hardship, as you know, not more than a couple of us here on the pod have experienced through this crisis, and so many of you listening may have as well. And then as you start to see yourself coming through it, it's, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but it is easier to identify with the people that are going through that struggle. And it just sort of reminds you that when you have the opportunity to help out, that, you know, if you, whatever you believe in terms of karma or unity or pulling together, it's just certainly the right thing to do. And so we're happy to do it. And I think it also absolves me of any suggestion that when I was siding with the players, not giving up their wages, that I was being curmudgeonly in that assertion. No, we want to help out, and we're happy to do it. So if you want to go to arsenalvisionpodcast.com/donate and click the button, it'll take you to Just Giving. Everything's on the up and up there, and it all goes to the Arsenal Foundation. And as I said, for every pound you give, we're going to match. We're going to blow away our goal. I am certain of that, because if Arsenal has proven anything, it's that the sort of global and local online community is still undefeated. So with that having been said, you know who isn't undefeated? Liverpool Football Club. And now it's pretty unclear what's going to happen with their season. Tim, France have now decided they're not going to have a rest of the league on or league de season. The Netherlands had already made that decision, I think, a week prior. And UEFA's putting mounting pressure on clubs to do something so that they can figure out how they're going to make their money down the road. And I'm just sort of wondering, as this all starts to coalesce, what your feeling is in terms of where this might be heading, and if you have any greater clarity personally on what you think the range of outcomes could be.
So I don't have any great clarity. I don't think anyone has clarity on the kind of how. But I think a few things have come to light in the last couple of, you know, in the last week or so, I guess. Actually, it's such a fast moving situation. But I think, first of all, you know, UEFA have basically said you cannot void the season and expect to come into our competition. So that's kind of, and personally, I'm happy with that. I don't think seasons should be voided. Well, I don't think the Premier League should be voided. I think that decision becomes much more understandable kind of lower down the leagues, for example, where playing behind closed doors, you know, for leagues that don't have enormous broadcast money attached to them makes no sense. And that's why, for example, I think it's an easier decision for the Dutch league to take. Because they're not as dependent on broadcast money. So it's easier for them to say, do you know what, this isn't going to happen. Whereas in, you know, the kind of big four, possibly big five leagues in Europe, that's more of a consideration. And I know people, and I get it, I get why people kind of, you know, consider that a kind of a tool of greed. But at the same time, you do have to acknowledge that that is where a lot of the money in football comes from. And if you cut it off, then however much you agree with the idea that that's where a lot of the money in football comes from, it just does. It's just an economic reality, and they have to deal with it. But also, what it looks like, as well as saying you can't void, it's looking like UEFA are starting to set deadlines for when things have to be resolved. And as much as I think still my natural inclination is to say, what is the rush? Just wait until you know, things are a bit clearer and play the seasons out once it's safe to do so. Why is there this big rush? And you know, sometimes I feel like there's an assumption that everyone's just kind of saying, oh, well, you know, like, let's just void it and start in September. And I'm kind of thinking, you think things are going to be back to normal in September? That's dream world. That's absolute dream world. They're not. Like, next season is not running from August to May or September to May. That is not happening. And European competition, that might not be able to happen next season at all. But on the other hand, to be fair, I think there are other considerations as well. So I think one of the reasons possibly UEFA is keen on setting a deadline, I think, is largely driven by their own competition. But I think they possibly see that if they just let everyone play their seasons out, everyone's season's going to finish at a completely different time. Like, we could have a scenario where the Bundesliga can get finished by August, and there are other leagues in Europe that can't even start at that point. So then what does Germany do? Just like sit on its hands for another 4 months and waits for everyone else to finish. So I understand that there's like a need for synchronicity. I think there are other things driving this as well. There's obviously the player contract thing. I don't think that's insurmountable. I think it's imperfect, as pretty much everything is going to be about this situation. I don't think it's insurmountable. But I think there are other things like, the financial cycles upon which clubs operate. So, for example, Arsenal, like most clubs, would be expecting a massive influx of season ticket renewal money by the 31st of May. That's usually the deadline to renew your season ticket. So that's 40,000 people handing over four figures to you. That's not going to happen this year. So, and there are a lot of things built into the club's planning and financial cycles that run from kind of June, July. And actually, one of the things I read earlier today as well is that the TV company, because a lot of people, I guess myself included, have been thinking, well, if you don't finish the season, the TV companies aren't going to pay for games that aren't going to happen. But apparently there is another payment due in July for next season. And perhaps an even bigger issue is TV companies going, well, hang on, if we don't know what next season looks like yet, why are we going to pay for next season? We're going to hold that money back. And I don't know which of those sums is greater. I imagine it's the one that's due in July. So maybe there's a consideration of, well, all right, we might have to kiss goodbye to like 9-10 games worth of broadcast money, but we'll do that because then we're giving the TV companies some certainty over next season. And, you know, if we make next season a full season, if we can try and just make that a normal 38 game season, then perhaps we get all of our money for next season. I still think that's maybe a bit optimistic to forecast that at this stage. I think the reality is, whatever happens, there is going to have to be flex built into it. Next season, whenever it happens, is not going to be able to be another 60, 65 game, you know, games every single day type of season. I don't think they can do that for a couple of years because it might get delayed again. There might be a second spike. Any number of things might happen that we just don't know about yet. And therefore, I think the reality is they're not going to be able to plan much more than a couple of months in advance. And so they're going to have to build some slack into the calendar. And that might mean getting rid of the domestic cup competitions. I'm dubious as to whether the European competitions will be able to happen anyway. And they might just have to say, do you know what, we're going to have to space this fixture list out a bit just in case we have to stop for another kind of 2 months or something. So there's all of that. I also think... And so the immediate reaction of particularly the Premier League clubs has been to try and ramp up the idea of being able to play again over the summer. And there is some speculation that the UK government is behind this because they see it as a morale boost for the country. If we can have some live sport on, I think the issue with this is the flip side of that. Imagine if they try to get football going again, and because of the delicacy of the situation, it's abortive and they have to stop it. Let's say we get it all back again. We get everyone back training. We have this 3-week build up and we go, right, yeah, this weekend it's behind closed doors, but it's on TV. You can watch it. Someone gets coronavirus, bang, it's all fucked. That would be terrible for morale. That would be absolute. That would completely negate any potential good that could come from sport coming back again. Like, how depressed will everyone be if we make an abortive attempt to bring football back? And that's why I don't think Germany are going to go quite as, or one of the many reasons I don't think Germany will go quite as early as they thought.
I'm going to go into dangerous territory here because it's going to make it sound like I believe in something that I don't believe in. So maybe I shouldn't say it, but I'm going to because that's so on brand for me. I mean, what if, as testing becomes more prevalent, as antibody testing becomes more prevalent, we determine that a much higher percentage of people had it than we expected. I know there was one test that was run in New York where like 21% of the people they tested had it, and that didn't even include some of the high-risk groups for contracting it, which means probably even a higher percentage did, which would obviously drive down the mortality rate numbers. And if they start to develop treatments that show they have a pretty good effectiveness at reducing the seriousness of symptoms should they develop. I mean, is there an argument that, sure, you still do it behind closed doors, but a player getting coronavirus isn't a cause for it to be abortive? I mean, if you say, oh, you know what? Half the players already have the antibodies because everybody had it, and the mortality rate's lower than we thought, and this treatment seems to be relatively effective, and, you know, these are healthy young men, so we're going to treat it like a pretty contagious illness, but not a mortality risk, and we're just going to go forward with it, and if someone gets it and they're too sick to play, they just don't play. I mean, is there a scenario, and Clive, I'm sorry, I will come to you in a second, I apologize, but is there a scenario where the health risks to the players could be viewed differently in a few months to where they say a player having it doesn't mean we have to stop this plan?
It's entirely possible, if that's the way things shake out and some kind of drugs become available to treat it and alleviate it. Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, we can't plan on with that on any certainty. And sorry to be slightly depressing here. I read an article earlier this week that was essentially saying one of the things about COVID is they still don't really have a handle on it. They're still finding things out. They're still finding different ways that it affects and impacts people. And
the blood clotting thing is really scary. Did you come across that one?
Yeah.
The strokes and things like that. Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, this article was saying by now they would expect, if not to be able to, you know, conquer it and cure it, they'd be able to map it. And actually, we still haven't quite hit that stage. There's still things that they're discovering, which makes me slightly dubious about potential treatments. I don't like, you know, listen, I'm talking about something I know very little about, so I'm relaying information here. But you're right. Like, it's a very fast moving situation. Like, something might happen in the next 2 to 3 weeks that makes it all completely possible. And frankly, I'm going backwards and forwards in my mind, because there is a big part of me as well that's thinking, well, you know what? At some point, it's going to have to start up again. And that's probably going to be in an imperfect scenario. Like, that they're probably not going to be able to wait until, you know, there's just a vaccine and everyone's had it, because everyone will go to the wall before that happens. And it's going to be the same for a lot of people going back to work and going back to workplaces. Like, that's going to happen in some phased capacity before we have the vaccine. People will be going back to offices and stuff. And therefore, you could say, well, why is football any different? Like, we will just have to live with a little bit of risk. That's kind of part of it. So that, you know, that could happen. You're quite right.
Yeah, I mean, because I think any suggestion that you're going to open anything up comes with the reality that someone's going to have it. And if you're saying, well, if someone has it, we shut everything down again, then you might as well not open up, because it is an inevitability that someone will have it. So I think you have to decide, we are never opening this, period. Or if we are opening it and someone has it, we are going to treat it like a, you know, chicken pox, you know, not like the plague. And again, that's not a scientific assessment. That's just a logistics assessment. So, Clive, I'll let you weigh in on this, and then I have a really interesting question for you that sort of red meat you can sink your teeth into. But that sounds good. Maybe I'll have some steak tonight. I think there is a real question about risk tolerance and the extent to which you expose people to risk. I mean, how important is it to finish a season? You know, setting aside tribalism and you know, wanting to laugh at Liverpool or not laugh at Liverpool. I mean, look, I have some sympathy with the idea that you're 30 years without winning a title, you're a fortnight away from celebrating it on record-setting pace, and you never get to. But in the interest of ever getting back onto a schedule that could approach normalcy, it would seem to me that scuppering this season and trying to start a new one in some semblance of a timely fashion is the smarter move for football. I get that that's not something Liverpool fans want to hear, and I get that that makes things thorny for UEFA and the teams that would compete in those tournaments, but isn't it fair to suggest that trying to plan forward for a new season starting reasonably on time is more sensible than clinging to the notion that you can somehow finish the season that you've just aborted and have it look anything like a real competition?
It's I think football needs to wake up and get itself out of its bubble, really, because you said about planning, and how can anyone plan anything at the moment because we're not in control. And the virus is in control. And the only reaction to it is just going to change things is science, basically. And the science is not there yet. As Tim alluded to, we are still learning about this new virus. And so I feel there's a huge unknown to how it reacts to different individuals, which doesn't allow us to take risk. I mean, we spoke about scenarios if football started and something went wrong. Just imagine if somebody famous got ill. And I use the word famous because there's been so many families that have been affected by this, but I think it needs to be somebody famous get ill through a football match and, you know, God forbid, something happened to him quite seriously. And we're going to ask ourselves how important this all is. And it is very important to us all. We love the game, etc. But we love the game. And we love all around the game. We were talking beforehand about the club, etc. And our memories of the club. And football is something which brings people together, right? So when you're not bringing people together, you're basically playing a training game. So the product we think about bringing back is not the product that we all know and love. Right, so
can I stop you there just for 1 second? I think that's such an important point, because if you're going to bring a product back that isn't what it was, using that product to presumptively finish a previous season makes it so divorced from, detached from what that previous season was that you're not really finishing the season anyway. You know what I mean? You're doing a different thing at that point.
Yeah, you're going for emotions, right? So I've watched behind closed doors games, and they're not the same. We take anything at the moment. If man has had steak for a year, then you give him a little bit of steak, it's lovely, right? So we'll take anything at the moment, but it's not the same product. It's not the same thing. And I think it's going to bring its own problem. So the government are thinking, well, it'd be a morale booster. Well, throughout my entire life, I have, in the main, watch football matches with other people. And so when, at the moment, I'm not going to the pub, I miss it. But when I do go to the pub, I normally go to the pub to watch football. This is football on, I'm going to really miss the pub. And people are going to replace it with something else. They're going to go around people's houses. There's going to be lock-ins in pubs behind shutters. There's going to be things happening around that game of football. And it is not going to be conducive to social distancing, I promise you. In the UK, we had a very sunny weekend, and I think most people will say maybe the rules of social distancing weren't quite as adhered to this weekend as they were the previous weekend. So it's a situation that's going to develop, and we're not in control, and we need to accept we're not in control. We need to accept that this is something that's moving very, very, very quickly. Science is trying to catch up with it. We're trying to catch up with it knowledge-wise. The government is trying to catch up with it. They didn't expect this to happen. I don't want to become political, but preparedness can be debated. And we're in a situation where this is something that's we're going to have to learn to live with. And what that looks like is very debatable. Living with something like this, that could, between the three of us, we could all get and have three different reactions, is something that has got too high a risk profile for me. Mm. And I think football needs to breathe, sit, wait, and stop holding itself to dates. Stop holding itself to principles that are no longer up to date. The principles of football, we need to rip them up. We need to rebuild them and start again based on what we can do. And whatever that is and whenever that is, and what we can do safely and morally. The situation yesterday, I think in the UK, I think there was around 423 deaths recorded in the hospital. And I thought, wow, isn't that much better? Obviously, there was a lag on numbers. If it gets to the point where I'm saying, wow, isn't that much better for 423 deaths in one day? That tells me that people are becoming sanitized to this and without really understanding the impact. I had a great show on TV the other week talking about where this is going to be in a few years' time. And we're talking about a National Health Service that's going to be massively under threat for a short period of time, for a period of time, which is going to be unknown. But it's going to be under a massive litigation threat going forward with all of the families that have lost people before their time and how they react. And this whole situation is going to make football feel small. You know, it's going to make it feel small because it's going to be something that's going to be around in our lives in some way or form for at least half a decade.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's really very, very concerning.
Yeah, the echoes of it, the reverberations of it, certainly. I mean, I have a friend who I went to law school with who is a litigator. And, you know, he's bemoaning the fact that his law firm was really struggling and they were going to have to lay people off or furlough people. But what he said is, you know, make no mistake, we're going to be overworked, you know, for the next decade, just litigating concepts like force majeure in contracts. You know, what is an act of God? And how do you get out of contracts? Or how do you enforce contracts? There's going to be a lot of that. And, you know, unfortunately, all of those things that are sort of boring and dry and political or legislative or whatever the case may be, contractual, they're going to have repercussions for the money in football, which goes a long way towards determining your club, the entertainment value, the players that you have and things like that. So I think you're spot on. So Clive and Tim, let's do this. Clive, I'll start with you on this one. Let's just for a minute dream up what the crazies at the head of UEFA or the Premier League might do with this opportunity. I mean, there is a saying in politics, never waste a good emergency, right? Or disaster. And it's sort of a dark joke meant that like politicians love to use an emergency as a chance to squeeze in all kinds of policy initiatives that they've always wanted to do because a lot of legislation gets passed very easily during emergencies and there's a lot of pork in it. There's a lot of, you know, sort of unrelated issues that get addressed in these massive spending bills. But I think the same could be said of football. Maybe they get rid of the League Cup. You know, maybe they get rid of the FA Cup. Maybe they change the number of teams in the league. Maybe they try to eliminate relegation promotion. I mean, who knows? There's nothing so crazy that it couldn't be off the table. One of the things that jumped to mind for me is, does European football need to look at an American model of salary caps, wage restrictions, you know, maximum amounts that can be spent, things like that? And the only way you can do that is if you eliminate relegation and promotion, which is at the very beating heart of league football. So, Clive, I'll start with you. Any sort of thought about what the masterminds behind both English and European football might try to squeeze through as a change to the game in the wake of this?
Yeah, I think when crisis makes you look at yourself and makes you look at what's working and what's not working, and we spoke the other week about the PFA, for me that's not working. There needs to be, you know, what I think you quoted, collective bargaining type agreements with player salaries. There needs to be control. We all know it's out of control. It first started with the oligarch type owners that came into the game. And then when the transfer market was getting under control, there's always a big transfer to take it out of control. And people are just reacting to this spend. And that trickles down within the game. It's making it unsustainable, you know. So what my fear is, you know, there's 92 league clubs in the UK and in England, sorry. And basically, there's a very healthy non-league. I just looked at the National League and Notts County are averaging over 5,000 people per home game. And that's in the non-league, right? So we got a situation where the game is incredibly important to so many people, all the way down the pyramid. But actually, my fear is it's going to be a breakaway, and because people are going to look at ways to recover lost revenue, and there's the haves, shall we say. If you look at the top six in the Premier League, the revenue between the person who's six, which I think is us actually in West Ham, I think we've got double the revenue in West Ham. There's a huge gap. There's a huge haves and have-nots. Regardless of what's going on the pitch, that's the truth of it. And that's going to be mirrored across the rest of Europe. So what does that say? What does that say we could be heading to? If you can have a smaller number of teams you can control, you can create masses of revenue by how that Super League is actually looked at and watched. And all the clubs say they're not interested in it, but trust me, they want to be where there's the most money to be made. And an opportunity, particularly next year, actually, that could be the one, but, you know, where they can actually look at a condensed way of football that you can control, that you want to try out. And potentially we could lose a season of normal football and have something less structured. And that could be within each country. That could be, you know, no cup competitions. That could be no European travel. You can go one of a number of ways. But I think it needs to, we need to be opening our minds up to it and not trying to squeeze in our role structures into a timeline which we are not in control of. Right? So we need to really free our minds and say, what are we trying to achieve here? What do we want to do? What can we morally, what is morally acceptable based on what's going on in the rest of life? What can we do to bring sport, because it's not just football, it's sport, sport back into the structures of everyday living, which is so important to so many millions of people, watching sport, participating in sport in a safe way. Now, amateur sport is really under pressure for the whole of this calendar year. So at the professional level, what can we do? You know, what can we control? And on the pay side of things, football has needed its financial reset for a while. We all know this. We were the only club that tried to live in a dream world of safe, self-sustainability and financial fair play. And look where it's got us. It hasn't really got us anywhere. So now we're in a situation where everybody's looking at their financials and their lost revenue and their benefactors. The last time I looked, people don't like losing. They don't like losing money. That's the one thing. There needs to be a reset in the game, and it's going to be so interesting to see how that impacts contractual negotiations, which I'm sure you'll get onto, and how that impacts players today in contracts and looking to get their next contract. It's just thrown. One of the things, obviously, we talk about loss of life, and that's most important. One of the big, big things about this whole thing is the loss of momentum for individuals and loss of ambition for individuals across the spectrum of life. You know, I'm not just a sporting spectrum. People that have momentum in their lives, that's been taken away. Ambitions in their lives have been taken away. And I think that's a really sort of a unheard damage, you know, and a sporting life is very, very finite window. And we really don't know when so many really highly skilled and hardworking and talented individuals will be able to get their sporting life back up and running.
Yeah, well said. Tim, I want to ask you the same question, and I'll just make a point because some people may not sort of understand why I said that relegation and promotion might have to go away. So I do think that there is a real question of whether football can be sustained long-term, and you can say, well, it's already proven it can be, but hear me out. With this idea that rich benefactor type owners can just come in and balloon the transfer fees to the moon, and balloon wages and come up with schemes for getting around financial fair play. And I know City got their wrist slapped, but let's face it, like, that doesn't take away any of their league titles. It doesn't take away any of the players from their squad. I don't know how long that's sustainable. Now you have Saudi Arabia coming in for Newcastle, and you know, this situation could just be further exacerbated. The way you prevent that is a salary cap, a wage cap, like you do in a lot of American sport, where you say basically every club can only spend X. And there are loopholes and things you can do and luxury taxes and things they've come up with. But by doing that, you level the playing field to an extent. And you also make running the club profitable. So suddenly you have owners that, you know, at least are in it, you know, to run it with some level of business responsibility, which I realize is not our first priority, but they're not doing it just as a tool for soft power or, you know, just to use it as a plaything. But here's the problem with a wage cap. What's the number one most predictive thing you can look at, criteria for where you'll finish in the league? Your wage bill. If all the wage bills are essentially even, then an Arsenal could finish first. An Arsenal could finish 20th. That will happen. Some of the best teams in the NFL sometimes finish dead last because they just have a bad season. There's some injuries. Because when everybody's wages are roughly within a band of similarity, you could finish anywhere. Well, once you tell owners you can't outspend your competition, you can't protect them from being relegated. And if you can't protect them from being relegated, why would they be in it? You're not going to own a football club that is worth more money, that has more prestige, that it has a bigger asset value, if it is at risk of winding up in the fourth tier of English football, right? So in order to bring in wage controls, you have to eliminate relegation and promotion. And it's such a fundamental part of the history of the game and the structure of the game, especially in England. I don't know how you do that. So that's why I say you'd have to eliminate relegation and promotion if you wanted to go to those cost controls. And I don't see how you get there. I mean, Tim, do you have any thoughts on how that could happen, if it could happen, or other things that the masters of football could try to sneak in through the door of this emergency?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. And actually, I think, well, so what is one of the key principles of the much vaunted European Super League? No promotion and relegation. Mm-hmm. How many US owners have we got in the Premier League now?
Quite a lot.
Quite a lot. Yep. You need 14 votes of the 20 teams to pass a resolution. I think you'd get those 14 votes regardless whether the owners are American or otherwise, because what's happening now particularly is that there are a lot of billionaires that own Premier League clubs now. So even someone like Newcastle can improve their lot, but it's not even with the unbelievable wealth they're about to avail of. It's not quite like Chelsea and City. When, you know, Roman Abramovich bought Chelsea, he was, you know, it was effectively the first real oligarch. I mean, we'd had rich benefactors have always existed, but, you know, the first real kind of oligarch, we've got a nation's wealth behind us type thing. And you looked at it and you went, well, Chelsea are going to win the league a few times. They'll eventually win the Champions League and they'll be one of the biggest clubs in Europe. And that's exactly what's happened. The same for Man City. But there's a critical mass of billionaires now. And unfortunately, after the horse bolted with Chelsea and Man City, eventually controls were bought in. And I know FFP is quite flimsy, but it still has had an impact. Look at Everton, for example. You've got Everton backed by a billionaire. It hasn't really done a lot for them. And they have spent loads and loads and loads of money. And they're still the best they can hope for is seventh. Maybe they can steal sixth, which, you know, as far as things go, is not a fantastic return on investment. Hmm. So you look at Newcastle and you think, okay, you're kind of floating around lower mid table. You're maybe a relegation threat, probably not at the moment when play stopped, but nobody would be massively surprised if they went down. With the control, they can't do what Roman Abramovich did. They can't just come in and go, right, we're spending £1 billion on the squad because of the controls that exist. So realistically, what Newcastle are doing is effectively going, well, maybe we'll qualify for the Europa League, which will be better than getting relegated, but it's still small beer, really. Therefore, yes, I think that if that vote was put before Premier League clubs right now, I think there's a good chance that 14 clubs would vote for it, particularly in this scenario. And just to expand slightly on the question you set particularly to Clive, you know, stuff like the League Cup, yes, the League Cup is going to bite the dust because it will have to go for one season anyway, and nobody's going to miss it, nobody's going to want it back. And you know what, we're going to lose some league clubs, so things like the League Cup, there's going to be a natural contraction anyway, because some clubs are going to go out of business and they're not going to be in the league anymore. And therefore, the structure of something like a League Cup won't work anyway. In terms of, I guess, innovative ideas, or not even innovative ideas, but ideas, I guess one I'd throw out there is the Women's Super League moved from a summer to a winter season in 2017. And the way they dealt with the transition, because the season was finishing in February, and they went, no, we want to line up with the men's game now. And the way they dealt with that gap was that from late March until early June, they did something called the Spring Series. And that was just, it was a league and everyone played each other once. And, you know, you got your fixtures and everyone played an equal amount of home and away games. But yeah, the league was slightly slanted. So, for example, in the Spring Series for Arsenal, they got their main competitors, Chelsea and Manchester City, away. They didn't get to play either of those teams at home. So, it was imperfect and it was slightly skewed. But you know what? It was a competition. And the great thing about it was it actually ended up being a really, really exciting competition. And the main reason, and this sounds a bit weird, but the main reason was that not everyone took it that seriously. And so what happened, for example, Arsenal decided to experiment with some young players because they thought, okay, this is a bit of a free swing. We've got, and bear in mind the league's smaller, so at the time I think it had 10 teams in it. It's got 12 now. They went, okay, we got 9 games here. We don't really care if we win the spring series or not. Like, that's not going to be like, you know, it's not going to be like a massive moment in our history. So we had a pair of teenage centre halves, and what we did was we played them in every single game, and it was really great fun. And some of the games that I saw in that little 2-month period, there was a 4-4 draw against Liverpool. There was a 2-2 draw against Chelsea with two goals in the last minute, one from each team. Like, there were some really, really good games. And part of it was, you know, sometimes how League Cup games are quite exciting because no one really takes it that seriously, and teams put their young players out and teams try things out tactically. That's kind of how the spring series turned out in the women's game. And I think, and particularly if you're talking about, you know, once football's ready to come back, not everybody is going to be in an emotional place to invest in it to the extent that they were when play stopped. So actually, you know, taking a little bit of the seriousness out of it anyway might be quite good. So doing something innovative with next season like that, or introducing some kind of playoff system. And they might have to do that anyway, because of what I was saying earlier, there's going to have to be slack in the fixture list. And maybe they say something like, look, if we have to stop again for a couple of months, we'll pick it back up with a playoff and we'll finish it that way. And they might have to just be, you know, take things as they go, and it might just be a really good chance for them to experiment with a few things that, you know, tradition has kind of blocked them from doing in the past. And if they don't work, fine, doesn't really matter. It was a tool of necessity, don't worry about it. They might work. We might really have an appetite for playoffs like they do in the States. Like, we don't really know, because we've never, other than in the Football League, we've never really tried it here. Like, I know in Brazil, for example, they loved the playoff thing. They went to like a European league system about 15 years ago, and every year there's the debate about bringing playoffs back. They've got much more of an appetite for it. Maybe we'll develop an appetite for it. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll think, no, this is rubbish, but we understand this is kind of a one-off. Like, there is an opportunity here, I think, to be a little bit creative, to create that flex, and to perhaps take advantage of the fact that people might not be as invested and they might be more prepared to do things like this. And they might think, well, okay, you know, we're going to play each other once a season, and yeah, maybe we've been a bit screwed on the fixtures because we've got to play like three of the top four away, but you know what, like, tough shit, that's just the way it goes, and maybe we can get like a little bit of that fun back that I think elite football is losing and has lost. It's become too serious. It's become, you know, I think VAR,
we just have to open our minds up, Tim. We just have to open our minds up to the possibilities that are ahead. Yep. And I, like I say, we have to throw away those structures. We are not in control. Yep. We're not in control of what we can do. What we have to do, like many businesses out there at the moment, is we have to be strong enough and positioned well enough to adapt to what's been, we are allowed to do. And I don't, you know, I care what it is, but I don't care what it is, as long as it's appropriate for the circumstances by which we are living. And I think that's the really key thing.
And, you know, like for me, personally, like a big watermark moment that's made me feel a bit more disengaged from the Premier League and the context that my club operates in is VAR. And it's not just because I happen not to like it and I happen to think it doesn't really work. But for me, it signals the moment that football started taking itself too seriously, the moment that it went, we cannot tolerate like a refereeing decision that we don't agree with. Like, this is too important. There's too much money. You know, this is too serious for us to tolerate that anymore. That's where like my big disengagement came with VAR. It's like, to be honest, like I don't like it, but I can tolerate like a 30-second or a minute stoppage in an hour and a half game. Quite often, like, large swathes of football games, nothing fucking happens anyway, and it's fine. But for me, it's the principle that that was the moment that we all started taking this too seriously, and it became work and not fun. Mm. And I really
sure it wasn't when you started the podcast.
No.
I think also, Tim, what it also did, and I mean, this has started for many, many years, you know, with people changing, you know, Premiership games at the last minute, and people like yourself having to rearrange travel arrangements and things like that. But what this finally did for me was it disrespected the people in the ground, and it really disrespected the fan in the ground, and it made people think, well, I might as well watch it at home. I might as well watch a stream. And now, potentially, there could be a reset there, because if we do play behind closed doors, I think people will now realise how important the fan is, and they've got to really think about the fan experience. And for many Arsenal fans, the fan experience for over recent years hasn't been great, because we've been so focused on winning or being in top four, etc. Or we're coming out of one manager, had a bit of a purple patch with a new one, then coming out of another one. So, you know, we make it what it is, and we enjoy the social, and we all get pissed up, and it's great. But it hasn't been what it used to be. But that's, I don't think that's just Arsenal. And maybe that's just me in my more mature years thinking about the game that way. But I do feel it's been a disconnect, and I felt it more this year, hence why I've been more involved in non-league football. I felt it more this year, and I think football needs to think very, very, very carefully about its connectivity to its fan base, and really, really recognise that it's important we have a product, and part of that product is the fan in the ground. And I think VAR was a step to caring more about the conversation in the TV studio rather than the people watching the game. And I think the soul of the game has been affected by it. And I said that from the start, and I think now we've all got time to breathe and think. It's not a VAR conversation. But hopefully at the end of this, when we all get back together again and we can sit next to each other, that the fan is recognised for what it actually is when it comes to the product of the Premier League.
Well said. Have to remember to take mute off when you're done talking. I got caught doing it, and I almost never mute because I just assume my mouth noises and tapping the table are things people want to hear, and this time I did it and I got burned. I think we should start to wrap up, but you know, I do think one thing that this does give us an opportunity to do is really reflect on what is it about football that we love, and what is it about football that we've just been conditioned to love. And I do think that there is a question I have for mid-table fans and lower-table fans, as someone who has recently become a mid-table fan. Surely there is more to be had from watching football than hoping you finish 11th and maybe get into a Europa League spot. Surely there is more to a season than hoping to escape relegation. The relegation battle is fun for the neutral, but it's not a thing to strive for as a fan. Now, maybe, I don't know, maybe if you're a Birmingham City fan, like, that's fine. And maybe if you're a Southampton fan, like, trying to get up to the Europa League places is fine. I can't imagine it is. It certainly doesn't feel that way to us as Arsenal fans, and that may be because we're spoiled brats. But, like, maybe there is a scenario where there is no relegation and promotion, and I don't know how you decide who's in that league, but maybe a Premier League where every team starts every season with dreams of a title, because there are cost controls, there are wage caps, and even small clubs, if they spend the wage cap, you know, can pulling a Leicester won't be a once in 100 years thing. It'll be a once in a 3 or 4 year thing. I mean, maybe that creates a game that engages us more, that brings back something that we didn't even know was lost. I don't know. I mean, we love football because we are addicted to it, but is the game healthy and good? I don't know that we could say it is. And I think everybody kind of just below the surface understands that. There are people, there are fans of the game right now, maybe a younger fan, whose way of following the game is to watch whatever highlights get posted on Twitter or in Reddit, watch goal clips, post memes, and have fun with the game that way, and play FIFA Ultimate Team. Like, the way people are connecting with the game is changing. So I think the idea that there are any sacrosanct legacies or traditions is just not accurate. And you know, the question... go ahead, Clive.
Sorry, mate. I was going to say, I think the way people consume the game is different. I mean, I think in the olden days, there were times when everyone sat and watched the whole live game. That's not the case anymore. People take snippets of the game. People follow the game online. people, they don't just sit and watch the game like we used to, because there's so much live football, it's almost saturated. So I think the way we consume it is differently. I'm not one for not having promotion and relegation, because that's all I've ever known. And I think it creates a jeopardy that we need to have. And I think if you look at the championship, almost every club in that championship, apart from maybe Luton Town, has been in the Premiership at some point. You know, and I think you need to have that sort of hope. You need to have the mountaintop ahead of you. And although I do think there's going to be a situation where there's going to be lost revenue recovery, and that could open us up to a separation, I generally hope it doesn't happen, because the pyramid is what makes the English game really special for me. And that pyramid needs to be kept in place, even though it's going to be contracted, because I do think some League One clubs and League Two clubs are going to find it very, very tough without some sort of bailout, because contractual expenses are still there and there's no revenue coming in. There's going to be a lot of footballers unemployed very, very quickly, with no chance of employment in the near future, particularly at a lower league level, and that is awful. It's absolutely awful, you know. And these guys are not on the money. We talk about Mesut Ozil, for example. So there is so much pain. There's so much reset to go through, and none of it's a controllable variable for us to manage going forward and plan against. We just have to wait. And I'm afraid the answer's in science. And until that gets sorted out, we can't even think about planning to the structures that we're normally used to.
The phrase that comes to mind for me is football is dead, long live football, because it will inevitably change and we will inevitably lap up whatever they give us. I don't think it is beyond considering that maybe what they've been giving us is a little more broken than we recognize, and that maybe there is another way to do it, that although it breaks with tradition, and breaking with tradition is hard and painful, may actually be better. Tim, I'll finish the topic just by asking. I mean, I'm sure you know fans of clubs that are not competing for titles every year. Is it rewarding to root for eighth place, to hope for a Europa League spot, to maybe finish top half of the table, have a couple of good days out? I mean, I think what's changed, right? Tim, when this was predominantly an activity that was at the stadium, you went to the ground, you had drinks with your mates, you sang the songs and you went home. Where you finished in the table was just sort of a byproduct of an activity that was social and celebratory. But now that the overwhelming majority of people consume it online and on television, for those people, it's not that experience. And so I have to wonder what the fans of those clubs, or how those clubs even attract fans to root for a mid-table existence. I mean, is there a way for that to work in a football game that now is dominated by TV money and broadcast revenue and streaming rights more than the experience at the ground?
Yeah, I mean this is not a new question, really, because like the Premier League still kind of has equalization of the TV money for that exact reason, because they know that the popularity of quote unquote the product relies on it being at least competitive. I'm not sure. Like, I think it was a really interesting discussion you guys just had. I think like looking at the way that millennials consume football is a worthwhile exercise at the moment. If you're thinking about this is a bit of a year zero, this is a bit of a millennium bug moment, and it all needs resetting anyway, and nothing's off the table, and all the traditions are out the window anyway. They've been thrown out the window for you. So looking at things like that, I think very, very worthwhile. And there's a chance to kind of take a breath and look into some of those things. The other thing is, I'm not sure how interested some audiences are in kind of it. Well, I think there are a lot of audiences that aren't interested in the league being equal. They're interested in what's best for their teams, and they consume their teams. And, you know, there's been a natural move towards that anyway. hence this podcast. People want like club specific content and stuff like that. But I do think as well that quite a lot of people, there is perhaps a generation that isn't as interested in perhaps the idea of the games being competitive. Like you look at Barcelona, for example. People, like, one of the big ways Barca make loads of money is that, like, Barca rarely sell out the Nou Camp. This is one of, like, the kind of the big lies of their success. They very rarely sell the Nou Camp out for most of their games, and the Nou Camp is a really bad, crumbling, I'd say dangerous ground, not even just decrepit, but dangerous actually to watch football in. And but the way they make their money is they charge their socios peanuts to watch, relative peanuts to watch games, but they charge tourists top dollar. They charge their one-time only customers lots of money, and they sell packages to people who come from other countries. And Barcelona's a beautiful city, so you go to Barcelona for the weekend, you have some tapas, you have some beer and some sangria, you go and watch Barcelona. Those people don't want to watch a 1-1 draw. They don't want to watch Getafe shithouse their way to a 1-1 draw. They want Messi to score 5 goals and for it to be 6-0, and then to go back out into Barcelona and have a couple of drinks. So actually, I'm not sure how important the equality of the competition is to some people, and therefore whether the powers that be will consider that an important thing to preserve or even to try and claw back. If you look at a list of the English League champions in the 70s, I think there's 7 teams that won it inside that decade. You know, it was hugely competitive. Wasn't very popular, though. Wasn't hugely popular. You know, a lot of the popularity is driven by these kind of huge brands in football, and that's why I think, as much as there's reason, not reason, but, you know, one of the hopes is there are good things that we can do. I think, unfortunately, the world doesn't work like that, and people's habits and people's voting habits and things like that shows you that's not really the world that people want either. The inequality is something that generally is of interest to a big part of the population, and therefore I think a European Super League will happen even quicker on the other side of this, because there are some clubs who are completely insulated from this, and they're going to come out of this and they're going to go, why are we with these peasants who've got the begging bowls out? We want to go and play with our mates, PSG,
exactly,
Juve. We want to go play with those guys, and the guys that, like, the ones that are still able to spend £50 million on footballers. We don't want, you know, we don't want, like, Southampton with the begging bowl, you know, rocking up at our place anymore. Like, I think, you know,
they're gonna want absolute certainty, Tim.
Yep.
They're gonna take it in the pocket right now because they have to, to protect their asset. But going forward, they're gonna say, "Oh, by the way, lads, I'm not doing that again." I want absolute certainty going forward.
Well, think of the financial reality, because here's the deal. Right now, if I said to you which is gonna get bigger viewership, Barcelona versus Manchester City or Manchester City versus Southampton, I think we know the answer. It's Barcelona, Man City, right? You know, Liverpool, Real Madrid, going to get more viewers than Liverpool, Birmingham City. And one of the reasons is not just the fact that Liverpool and Birmingham City is not even matchup. It's that there's very, very, very little at stake in some ways, right? One of the teams is going nowhere. Granted, for Liverpool, there may be a lot at stake because you can only drop, you know, 9 points in a season these days and still win the title. But I think what I'm trying to say is if you could create parity in the league through wage controls, you are more attractive to ownership. You are more attractive to fans of 75% of the league. And now suddenly, every single game in the league has the potential to be a game between teams contesting the league title. And then now you don't, you have something, because you could maintain some existing local rivalries. You maintain the intra-England feel of the league and the sort of intensity and passion that stokes, the fan support, but you make these games have something on the line, because if they do create a European Super League like that, those games are going to be bigger. Will they ever reach the same intensity that a league game can have in terms of the support and the passion? I don't know. But those league games have to go back to meaning something. And for 80% of the league, when they meet each other, when a Southampton plays a Birmingham City, you know, hell, at times this season when an Arsenal plays a Watford or something, it just doesn't mean anything. And that's no good for anybody. So football needs their games to matter and matter for more people. And the less the fan at the ground is the driving factor in the economy of football, the more the structure of football has to be of interest to the fan watching at home. And Tim, I know that's going to rankle you a little bit because that's not how you connect with football. But economically speaking, the money from football now comes more from streaming rights / TV rights than it does from ticket sales. And if that's the case, and that need that that machine's got to be fed, you feed it by making the games matter to the viewer. You can no longer say, "Oh, yeah, hey, it's about a piss up and your friends," and you know that's the story that football was able to tell people to get away from having to actually have some of these teams mean anything, you know, competitively. So it'll be interesting. Look, we've hit the hour mark on a topic that we will have a lot of time to discuss. I was going to ask you what you thought of Saka's cryptic tweet with a what are those things
Beast
called?
Dame.
The thing you turn it over and sand runs through it and it,
the egg timer.
But it's called the hourglass, an hourglass. Jesus.
Yes.
Goodness sake. Also my favorite shape. Never mind. So yeah, we were going to discuss that, but you know what? It'll all be determined. Clive is convinced it means he's staying, so that's good. We can move on. Clive's on Twitter at ClivePFC. Thanks, Clive.
Thank you very much.
Tim's on Twitter at Stroberto. Thanks, Tim.
My pleasure as always.
My name is Elliot Smith. You can block me on Twitter, Yankee Gunner, and give generously. Or if you can't and do not have the means, then we are with you and we care for you and we hope that there is support for you. And hopefully maybe some of this support will find its way to you, but we are all in it together. So if you want to do it, you can go to arsenalvisionpodcast.com/donate. arsenalvisionpodcast.com. You'll see a banner on the site, or you can just go to arsenalvisionpodcast.com/donate. It'll take you to the Just Giving page. I'd give you the Just Giving page, but it's like a long URL. But if you want to look it up there, it's the Arsenal Vision podcast one. And we want to thank the Arsenal Foundation so much for helping us understand how to do this, put this together, and execute on this so we can raise some great money for a great cause. So we're all in it together. We love you, and we will talk to you after Arsenal 20, COVID-19.